The theme of our lesson this morning is that the Lord is the only reliable refuge. This is very similar to the theme of our lesson last Sunday, which is that God is the only true refuge. But last Sunday's lesson, the prophecies were directed towards the pagan nations that surrounded. Why don't y'all come on up to the front? You won't bother anything. Just come on up, and we're just getting started. Get some coffee on the way. It was directed to the pagan nations surrounding Judah. And God was telling them, you need to find refuge. You need to find your refuge in me. And then come and worship the God of Judah. Well, today's lesson, it's directed to the land of Judah itself, the people there, because they were going off and trying to find their refuge and their safety in other sources than in the true God, Yahweh. So the Lord is the only reliable refuge. If your Bibles are not already open to Isaiah 18, please open them there. And I may have mentioned this before, but Isaiah is a beautifully written book. It is written so beautifully that its beauty can even survive the translation into another language, such as English. Listen to the first couple of verses of Isaiah chapter 18, our passage this morning. He writes, "Alas, O land of roaring wings, which lies beyond the rivers of Cush, which sends envoys by the sea, even in Epaphras vessels on the surface of the waters. Go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the rivers divide." I mean, isn't that beautiful? We might not know what the roaring wings or the land divided by the rivers is all about, or who those tall and smooth people are that are feared far and wide, let alone the papyrus vessels. But the passage itself is beautiful. It's one of those passages that if you memorized it in high school, it would stay with you for the rest of your life. There are some questions that we need to address before we delve any further into the passage, and they are, obviously, what land are we talking about, and why is it identified by whirring wings? What's with the land, the rivers dividing the land and it being beyond the rivers of Cush? Why were they sending envoys over the sea in those flimsy vessels of papyrus? And who were the people that were tall and smooth, feared far and wide, powerful and oppressive? We will address each of these questions, but before we do, there are a couple of things I need to let you know about the passage before we get too far into it. Things that would not be clear until you get to chapter 20, which is the end of the passage, and then you'll read them and say, well, I wish I'd known that back in chapter 18 and 19. You know, the whole passage might have made more sense to me if I had known in chapter 18 and 19 what I now know in chapter 20. So a few things we need to cover about the passage before we get into it, and that is that the prophecies regarding these two nations of Cush and Egypt are really intertwined. Chapter 18 is about Cush, chapter 19 is about Egypt, and chapter 20 is about Egypt and Cush together. If you look at the outlines of your table, you can see that's kind of how we've got it structured. But if you look more closely, you'll see that the Messiah, and remember, this whole portion of the book of Isaiah is structured around the Messiah, the burden, the oracle regarding particular different nations. Well, this Messiah does not begin until chapter 19, verse 1. The Messiah about Egypt, or the burden or the oracle concerning Egypt. So chapter 18, talking about Cush, serves as a sort of preamble to this chapter, to this passage. Chapter 18 is the preamble. Chapter 19, Egypt, is the main body of the Messiah. And chapter 20 is a summary of the entire passage. And in chapter 20, verse 4, God states that this is a summary about both of the two nations together. So it's a prophecies regarding these two nations are really intertwined because God says so in Isaiah 20. And another reason to regard the prophecies of the two nations as intertwined is to understand that from history, in year 715 B.C., and you can see where that is. I started to point to the wrong screen there. Right there. That's right in the middle of Isaiah's ministry. Year 715 B.C. There was a Cushite by the name of Shabako. Fine boy's name. Any of those expecting, you might keep that one in mind. This Cushite named Shabako gained control of Egypt, and he established the 25th dynasty of Egypt. And we don't know when in Isaiah's ministry that his prophecy occurred, whether it was before, during, or after Shabako taking control of Egypt. But we know from chapter 20 that this prophecy would have been no later than 714 B.C. at the latest. And its fulfillment would involve both nations. Next thing we need to understand about the passage. So they're really intertwined. God said so in chapter 20, verse 4. And besides, the Cushites took control over Egypt, so the two nations are really mixed up here together. The next thing we need to understand about the passage is that the passage will contain both near-term and end-time fulfillments. Some of the things that Isaiah wrote about in the passage would be fulfilled pretty close to the time frame of Isaiah. They would occur after his ministry, actually, but not too long after his ministry. Others will be fulfilled during the millennial reign of Christ. Most of the time, it's clear which one we're talking about. Okay, some of the time. At least some of the time, it's clear which one we'll be talking about. Finally, if you can use the word finally in regard to introductory material, we need to understand why the bad things in the prophecy are going to happen. Egypt and Cush, like all other nations, had their list of sins against God, for which he could have judged them. But in this passage, there's not a verse, there's not a sin listed in the prophecy that is the cause of the bad things happening. It's not like God says, for this sin or for these sins, I'm coming against you in judgment. These bad things are going to happen, but God never states that it's happening as a result of any particular sins. We get to the end of the passage. Isaiah chapter 20, verses 5 and 6, we see the purpose of the prophecy. Reading Isaiah chapter 20, verse 5, then they shall be dismayed. And we'll find out that they is talking about certain people in Judah. They shall be dismayed and ashamed because of Cush their hope and Egypt their boast. So the inhabitants of this coastland, Judah, will say in that day, behold, such is our hope, where we fled for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria, and we, how shall we escape? The prophecy was given because the people of Judah were understandably afraid of an impending invasion by the mighty Assyrian Empire. And they looked to, rather than looking to their mighty God Yahweh for protection and deliverance, they looked to other human sources, specifically their powerful neighbor to the south. Had been a powerful military force for centuries, if not for over a millennium. 7 centuries earlier, just following the Exodus, God had specifically warned the people in Deuteronomy 17:16 against returning to Egypt. And that meant even for the purpose of obtaining items of defense. Now God was once again letting the people know through Isaiah that they should not look to the Egyptian Cushite alliance for help, because those nations would fall. But they should look solely to Him, because He was the one in control of all the nations, and He would never fall. Now, before we begin to answer those questions that I promised you we would answer, we have to consider the opening word of the passage. It is, alas. As we've stated before, the Hebrew word is hui. The very sound of it is exclamatory and it's sad. As a general rule of prophecy interpretation, if a prophecy begins with the word alas, what does that mean? This is easy. Start with bad news. Something bad's going to happen if it starts with the word alas. Conversely, if the prophecy begins with rejoice, what does that mean? Something good. Something good's going to happen. But this prophecy begins with the word alas. And, it's an expression of compassion in this instance rather than anger. We get to the end of this short prophecy about Cush in chapter 18, and we see that there is a declaration of what I would consider to be a very favorable set of circumstances for Cush. And we would wonder why Isaiah would declare alas over such a favorable outcome. The answer is that bad stuff has to happen before the good stuff. And again, we get to that bad stuff at the end of the passage in chapter 20. So that's why God had Isaiah begin by saying, alas. Well, let's start answering these questions. About what land are we talking? There's nearly uniform agreement among the Bible commentators and scholars that the land we're talking about is Cush, or as it's translated in some versions, Ethiopia. The ancient Ethiopia of Old Testament times, however, is not in the same location that modern-day Ethiopia is, so the newer translations they tend to go with the translation Cush as opposed to Ethiopia. You get back to the King James, older translations, they'll use Ethiopia, the newer ones, New American Standard, NIV, ESV. They'll tend to go with the word Cush just so there's not a misunderstanding about the location of the place. All we know for certain, though, about the location of ancient Cush is that it was immediately south of ancient Egypt, where the Nile River could no longer be navigated due to the cataracts, and also the land around the Nile River was not very well suited to agriculture because of the granite outcroppings in that region, which caused the cataracts, the shoals and such, the rapids, which made the Nile River not navigable. The language of Isaiah seems as though it's referring to a land a little further south than what this map shows, and we'll get into that in just a few moments. Well, why is this land identified with whirring wings? Alas, O land of whirring wings. What is that all about? We don't know for certain. And this is the fun part of reading commentaries. If as long as you're not trying to gather material for a lesson, I guess it would be fun. Looking back, someday I'll laugh about it, you know. But the wide range of explanations. Things from it means that there's lots of insects. It means there's lots of birds. It means a mighty army with spears and arrows. It means a motley assembly of various tribes of people. Even the whirring wings being a poetic reference to sails on boats of the Nile. I don't know where they got that. I mean, everything except, I read just about every explanation except being the blades of a helicopter. But I didn't read all the commentaries. I mean, I usually, Usually I'll stop before I get to those commentaries. But perhaps the most likely interpretation is that it refers to an abundance of winged insects, particularly locusts. But that takes a lot of the beauty of the passage out of it for most of us. Or perhaps they've missed the translation completely when they say whirring wings, and it should be something more along the lines of a shadowy borders. You know, shadowy, whirring, borders, wings. Hey, Hebrew's tough. Translation from Hebrew is the tough. But that's very similar to how the King James would translate it. Something along the line of shadowy borders. We're not sure what the whirring wings mean, but boy, isn't it pretty. Doesn't it make the translation pretty? Alas, O land of whirring wings. Well, what's with the rivers dividing the land and it being beyond, or as some translations put it, alongside, the rivers of Cush? I think there are two plausible explanations, and the two possible explanations that I'll mention involve two different areas that are right adjacent to each other. The first, The first is the same region that I showed you on the map earlier, and it's that area that's been identified by many as ancient Cush. This would work if you interpret beyond as alongside the rivers of Cush, which is a valid translation. The rivers dividing the land, that could refer to just about any land, particularly you could call it Mesopotamia, whose land means, as the name means, land between the rivers. But since the rest of the text makes it plain that we're talking about Cush, we can see from the map that the Nile River divides the land, and the Nile River itself is divided by the land into its two main tributaries, the White Nile on the west and the Blue Nile on the east. Furthermore, while all rivers posed barrier to travel by land in the ancient world, the cataracts of the Nile were notorious for doing so. And this is where, preparing the lesson, you just have to stop. You say, I can't keep on throwing stuff in there, can't keep on throwing pictures, but you can Google cataracts of the Nile. You'll come up with some fantastic pictures of photographs of them today, and even more fascinating to me were the depictions of the writers in the 1800s and 1700s as they would be doing their books, and they would try to put in pictures of people trying to cross the Nile from one side of the other to the other, one side of the Nile to the other, where the cataracts were, and just the ropes and trying to get across them. Well, the land was really divided by the river in this region. But the other area would be a little bit further south. If you go beyond the regions of northern Cush. And this map here, this area that is shown on this map as being where they thought Cush was, would correspond to around this area here. Yeah, you can see the big bend in the Nile there, and then you can see where the Nile splits into the White Nile and the Blue Nile. And you can see this is where they've identified Cush as stopping on the map to the left. But if you go beyond the region of Cush, look what you get into. You get into the headwaters of the Nile River with its many tributaries, and even into the 1800s, they were still trying to go up the Nile River to find where you would call the beginning of the Nile. Why would Isaiah and zero in on this particular region is kind of unclear, but I'm inclined to believe that this is the region because later in the prophecy in chapter 19, it's going to focus very much on the Nile River and God striking the Nile. And God, it's like he starts here with the very headwaters of the Nile. And he said, you know, from the headwaters down to the delta, I'm going to smite the life blood of the Egyptians from its very source. And from this map, you can see that some scholars would put Cush to cover that entire region. Well, why were they sending envoys over the sea in flimsy vessels made of papyrus? Who can tell the class what papyrus is, by the way? Not everybody might remember their fifth grade social studies to remember what papyrus was. Used to make scrolls, and what did they make the scrolls out of? Papyrus, okay. It's kind of like what? Paper. Why would you send somebody out in the ocean on a paper boat, presuming you liked them? Why would you put your kid in a cardboard boat, Matt? I don't know. But it floated, and they won. So, another story. The answer is that these vessels made of papyrus were not necessarily flimsy. Now, these are not Egyptian. These, I believe, would probably be from South America. The photos I found didn't identify where they were, but they're very similar to the designs. As I saw the pictures of what the Egyptian papyrus vessels would look like, they're very similar to this. These are actually made out of reeds and grass, and they use them, I think, on Lake Titicaca in South America. But very similar would be the Egyptian boats of papyrus, and they're not not flimsy at all. The type of reeds to make papyrus grow, I'm told, or grow almost exclusive, make papyrus. They grow almost exclusively, I'm told, in the Nile Delta of Egypt, and the climate of Egypt, the hot and dry climate, is precisely what they needed to make papyrus. The Egyptians were noted for sailing their papyrus vessels along the Nile, and the Cushites would actually make papyrus vessels that could be collapsed and folded up. So when they got to the cataracts, they could fold them up, walk around the cataracts, unfold their boat, get back in it, keep on sailing. The commentator Franz de Litch talks about how history records that these papyrus vessels would have sailed as far as Sri Lanka off the southeast coast of India. Southwest would have been impressive enough. They made it up to the southeast. But the papyrus vessels were not flimsy. The sea over which they were sailing could have been the Mediterranean, or it could have been the Red Sea, or most likely it was the Nile River. Not uncommon at all for the Hebrew word sea to be used in reference to any body of water, especially a large river such as the Nile. But why were they going out? Now, we don't know. Perhaps they were another nation that was trying to negotiate a military alliance with Judah in face of the coming Assyrian aggression. That would fit in with the overall message of the prophecy concerning Judah seeking to find safety in the alliance with Egypt. If so, Egypt and Cush were the much greater military power, and they were enlisting the aid of a much smaller one. Perhaps they viewed the Judean territory as a pawn, and cushion at the same time. But a cushion to kind of buffer with the coming Assyrian attack. The swift messengers that are going to Cush in verse 2, I believe, are not the same person as the envoys that are coming from Cush, also in verse 2. The swift messengers could either be those who are to deliver Isaiah's message to Cush, or it could be angels who are about to bring its fulfillment. Well, finally, we come to the question, who were the people tall and smooth, feared far and wide, powerful and oppressive? Well, they were the Cushites, who were a tall people. They were bronze-skinned, and they were smooth-shaven, as opposed to the bearded people of the Mideast. So in these first two verses, we see most poetically that something sad is going to happen to Cush. Let's continue reading to find out what it is. Here is the message verses 3 to 6 of chapter 18. The message that these swift messengers are to take to Cush. Verse 3, all you inhabitants of the world. By the way, so it's not just going to Cush, it's going to all the inhabitants of the world. All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on earth, as soon as a standard is raised on the mountains, you will see it. And as soon as the trumpet is blown, you will hear it. So this message is not going to be a secret fulfillment. It's not only for Cush, but it's for all the world. And it will be known and it will be observed by all the world. Verse 4. For thus the Lord has told me, I will look for my dwelling place quietly, like dazzling heat in the sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heaven in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, as soon as the bud blossoms and the flower becomes a ripening grape, then he will cut off the sprigs with pruning knives and remove and cut away the spreading branches. In verses 4 to 6, we have the imagery of God as a farmer. And he does not act when man, with his limited wisdom and insight, thinks that he should act. But he waits patiently until he knows that the time is right. Now, I'm not a farmer. I don't understand much of the language that he says here. But what we do understand that God knows when the time is right. And then he acts and he does the pruning that needs to be done. Verse 6. They, meaning the things that go, the sprigs that God has cut off, they will be left together for mountain birds of prey, and the beasts of the earth, and the birds of the prey will spend the summer feeding on them, and all the beasts of the earth will spend harvest time on them. At that time, a gift of homage will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth, even from a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the rivers divide, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, even of Mount Zion. So, this prophecy that's going to be widely observed and going to happen on God's timetable will involve a great slaughter. It'll be so great that bodies will be left unburied, and birds of prey and wild animals will spend the summer and the harvest time feeding on them. There's going to be so many. There's at least two possible times when the prophecy regarding this pruning and the great slaughter may have been or will be fulfilled. The first may have been God's slaughter of the Assyrian army during Hezekiah's reign, that's recorded for us in Isaiah 37 and elsewhere, in which 185,000 Assyrian soldiers were miraculously struck dead by one angel from God in a single night outside Jerusalem. 2 Chronicles 32:23 tells us that after that great slaughter, the nations sent gifts to Hezekiah. It doesn't specifically record Cush as being one of them. But the nations sent gifts to Hezekiah and also sacrifices to the God of Judah after that deliverance. It may have been the fulfillment of verse 7 of this morning's passage. The second possible fulfillment, which is the one to which I lean, is the still future battle that is prophesied in Ezekiel 39 and Revelation 19. Now, I lean that way because this message is directed to all the nations of the earth, and this battle is going to include many nations, and it specifically lists Cush as being one of the nations that will be in that future battle. Now, Cush is not a region that we consider to be a great military power, a great global military power by any stretch of imagination at all today. But Ezekiel prophesies of that battle that the slaughter is going to be so great that it's going to take the people of Israel 7 months to bury all of the dead from it. So either of those could be plausible fulfillments of the prophecy. I lean towards the second. Well, the language of chapter 18 is beautiful. And though many of its meanings may remain unclear, these facts are crystal clear. And these are the ones we go to the bank on. Something very, very sad was and or is going to happen to the people of Cush. But its final outcome will be very good, with the people of Cush giving homage to the Lord of hosts and doing so in Jerusalem. Well, let's move on to chapter 19, talking about Egypt. And the first 15 verses are a poetic description of the destruction that's going to be coming to Egypt. The oracle, or the Messiah, concerning Egypt. Verse 1. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. The idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. Now, just as the opening verse of chapter 18, the language here, the first verse of chapter 19, lets us know something bad is going to happen to Egypt. The judgment, there's judgment, and there's destruction coming their way, and it's coming quickly. Pastor Pennington has been reading Romans chapter 1 to us in sermons these past few weeks, and Egypt is an example from history of that fulfillment, of the way in which people turn from knowledge of the true God to serve idols. There was a time in Egypt's history when they were monotheistic, and it wasn't correct and true monotheism. It was aberrant, but it was monotheism, and they suppressed this truth about the one living God. Although they knew about him from the time of Moses and the people in the land, they suppressed the truth about the one living God, and their minds became darkened and depraved, and they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God to worship lifeless images in the form of men who were corruptible, and in the images of birds and four-footed animals and detestable crawling things. Verse 1 tells us that those idols are now going to tremble in the presence of the Lord. I love the language. It's like when a big dog comes in the yard and another dog feels subservient to it. And that subservient dog will start to quiver and shake, you know. Or it's like when a big Dodge pickup truck pulls up to the light right next to a Ford. And that little Ford starts to quiver and shake, you know, right? Trying to get away from that big Dodge. But these idols, they're going to shake. That's how these false gods of Egypt are going to be in the presence of the Lord God Yahweh. And the hearts of the Egyptians will also melt within them. And we'll not read all of chapter 19 in class this morning. Please read that in your own personal study time. But chapter 19 details many bad things that will happen to Egypt. There's going to be internal civil war, demoralization, and dependency on the occult until the Egyptians would be delivered into the hands of a cruel master. Now, many of those things were fulfilled with the conquest of Egypt by Assyria in 671 B.C., and others were not. Most notably, chapter 19 talks about the Nile River drying up. And that hasn't happened. We get to the end of chapter 19, and some really incredible prophecies are listed, which haven't taken place yet. If you haven't read it before class, don't read it now. I want you to be surprised when we get to it, because it's very surprising. I think the majority of chapter 19 prophecy regarding Egypt was going to find its fulfillment during the time of the millennium and the tribulation that follows. This chapter 19 relates metaphorically the drying up of the Nile River. It related metaphorically in Isaiah's time, but I believe it's going to be fulfilled literally in the time of the tribulation. And when the Nile dries up, what happens to Egypt? Every element of Egypt's economy dries up with it. The bulrushes for ancient Egypt, those bulrushes from which that precious papyrus of Isaiah's time was made, they're gone. Agriculture is gone because it lacks both water and the nutrients that were supplied by the Nile every year when it flooded over into the land. It enriched the land. It's gone. The fishing industry of the Nile particularly important in Isaiah's time will be gone. And Isaiah 19 talks about each element of the economy gone, gone, gone. You know, it's destroyed. The agricultural industry included not only food for crops, but also cotton. Anybody ever heard of Egypt growing cotton? Please tell me yes. It fed the industrial production of cotton cloth, that cotton cloth from Egypt, you know. Every aspect of the Egyptian economy is destroyed. And chapter 19 says that the hired laborers will be grieved in soul. And it continues through verse 15. But then we get to verse 16. And these are some of the most incredible prophecies that I find in the Bible. Verses 16 through 25 regarding Egypt. And even though, when I read them, there's five specific things recorded about in that day. And every time I read this passage, even though I know what they're going to say, I have to read them again. Because they're so incredible. It's so hard to believe that what they say is going to happen is going to happen. Let's read this portion together. Beginning with verse 16, we have the very first in that day. Verses 16 and 17. In that day, the Egyptians will become like women, and they will tremble and be in dread because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he is going to wave over them. And the land of Judah will become a terror to Egypt. Everyone to whom it is mentioned will be in dread of it because of the purpose of the Lord of hosts, which he is purposing against them. Okay, the first one isn't too surprising at all. More bad things for Egypt. God's going to be against them, and they're going to be scared of Judah. But they are bad things for a purpose, and they're necessary for God to work out the next four in that days, which get better and better. In that day, number two, verse 18 and 19. In that day, five cities in the land of Egypt will be speaking the land of Canaan and swearing allegiance to the Lord of hosts. One will be called the city of destruction. Okay, this one's a little surprising. What's the significance of five cities in Egypt speaking the language of Canaan? Well, the Egyptians were, and they still are, very prejudiced against the Hebrews. But that's going to change to the extent that they will adopt their language. Now, just as incredible as that would have been in the time of Isaiah, imagine how incredible it's going to be in our day, or in the day in which this prophecy is fulfilled. Even more incredible is the fact that they're going to swear allegiance to the Lord of hosts. Can you imagine those Muslims over there in Egypt swearing allegiance to the Lord of hosts? That's right. Read it again. That's what's going to happen. These five Egyptian cities will be swearing allegiance to the God that we worship, the Lord of hosts. One of the cities will be called the City of Destruction. Or a more likely reading would be the City of the Sun, Helopolis. That was the center of the Egyptian practice of worshiping the sun, that aberrant monotheism that I mentioned earlier. This is a complete turnaround from idolatry and false religion to worshiping the true God. We read this and we say, wow, five cities in Egypt worshiping the Lord. That's really nice. But wait, there's more. We have in that day, Numbers 3 and 4 combined, verses 19 through 22. In that day, there will be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt and a pillar to the Lord near its border. And it will become a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they will cry to the Lord because of their oppressors, and he will send them a Savior and a champion. And he will deliver them. God's doing this for Egypt. And thus the Lord will make himself known to Egypt. And the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day. They will even worship with sacrifice and offering and will make a vow to the Lord and perform it. And the Lord will strike Egypt, striking but healing. So they will return to the Lord. and he will respond to them and will heal them. Those five cities were just the beginning, people. From those five cities, a great awakening and a turning to God will spread across Egypt. Egypt will cry out to God because of some oppressors. And the Bible says that God will hear them and will send to them a Savior and a champion who will deliver them just like He's delivered us. And lest there be the slightest bit of doubt remaining in our minds, God says it plainer than plain that He will make Himself known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will know Him in that day. Egypt, who's been nothing but bad news and bad trouble for the people of God throughout the Old Testament, that represents the world from which we are supposed to flee ourselves, that Egypt is going to know, worship, and serve the true living God in that future day. God will strike Egypt as described in this chapter 19, but He will also heal them, causing them to turn to Him and worship Him. But wait, there's more. I mean, verses 23 to 25, the fifth in that day. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrians will come into Egypt and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. In that day, Israel will be the third party with Egypt and Assyria, and a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, "Blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." We are still reeling from the revelation that the future Egyptians will be worshiping Yahweh. And now we are knocked over by the declaration that, oh, by the way, the Assyrians are coming for dinner too. You know, what is Assyria? Assyria is modern-day Iraq, Syria, and Iran. Get the picture. You got Egypt and the Assyrians and Israel skipping down there, holding hands, skipping down the road together, singing "Joy to the World" as they're going to Jerusalem. Incredible. It's absolutely incredible. It kind of turns everything else in Bible prophecy on its end about things that are going to be happening. This highway. Got a map here. Whoops. Thought I had a map. I guess not. I thought I had my map. My apologies. I don't have my map. But this highway represents a good thing. It means a travel for peace and perhaps for commerce, definitely for worship. The people of ancient Judah would have heard Isaiah's prophecy and been in shock to hear that not only would those idolatrous pagans and their former slave masters, the Egyptians to the southwest, but also their feared enemy, those cruel and heartless Assyrians to the northeast, would be coming to join them and worshiping the one true God. It's like Isaiah said, "So, Mr. Lamb," to Judah, "Mr. Wolf and Mr. Bear are going to come to your house for dinner tonight, and you're not the main course. You know, you're all going to have a nice dinner together, worshiping the true God." Absolutely incredible. Can you imagine any nations today that hate Israel more than do Egypt, Iraq, Syria, and Iran? Maybe some might get as much. None of them get more. Yet God paints the pictures of these three people together, calling them what? His blessing. "This is my blessing in the midst of the earth." Jerusalem is going to be the center of the world in the millennium, and these people are His blessing right there in the middle of it. Well, the immediate application for us from chapter 19 is to believe that the calling of God when God calls a person to believe, it's all the work of God. And therefore, no person, underline that, no person is beyond the reach of the gospel. none of your Jewish relatives, none of your Muslim friends, no person, none of my Jewish friends from high school, none of your atheist friends, none of your agnostic, none of the most immoral, none of the gay couples living together. No person is beyond. There's no person that you can name. None of your religious friends is beyond the reach of God's saving power. That's a takeaway that we have to take away from 19, chapter 19. Okay, chapter 20. Chapter 20 is the naked truth. And it's about Egypt and Egypt and Cush together. Chapter 20, verse 1. In the year that the commander came to Ashdod, now that year would have been 711 B.C., and Ashdod was one of the five cities of the Philistines that we talked about last week. So when the commander came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and captured it, at that time the Lord spoke through Isaiah the son of Amoz, saying, "Go and loosen the sackcloth from your hips and take your shoes off from your feet." And he did so, going naked and barefoot. It was certainly a tough assignment to be an Old Testament prophet. This was one of those good news, bad news days for Isaiah. The good news was that for 3 years he would not have to wear that uncomfortable and unstylish sackcloth that was the typical garb for a prophet. The bad news is that he would wish that he had it. The commentators are just about universal in stating that Isaiah most likely would not have been completely naked, but that he was probably naked down to a loincloth, which would have been plenty embarrassing enough. Verse 3, "And the Lord said, even as my servant Isaiah has gone naked and barefooted 3 years, as a sign and token against Egypt and Cush, so the king of Assyria will lead away the captives of Egypt and the exiles of Cush, young and old, naked and barefoot, with their buttocks uncovered," so they would have been completely unclothed, "to the shame of Egypt." And this was fulfilled shortly after Isaiah's ministry in 671 B.C., when Assyria conquered Egypt. Then, verse 5, "Then they shall be dismayed and ashamed because of Cush their hope and Egypt their boast. So the inhabitants of this coastland will say in that day, 'Behold, such is our hope, where we fled for help, to be delivered from the king of Assyria. And we, how shall we escape?'" So chapter 20, especially the concluding verse 6, pulls the entire prophecy of chapters 18 and 19 regarding Cush and Egypt together. Judah was not to look to the military might of Egypt and Cush southwest as a potential source of protection against the threatening attack of Assyria. For God would cause those nations to fall and to fall before Assyria. Judah was to look to God alone as the source for its protection. Well, what is our application from our lesson this morning? First, for the now, just as Judah should have looked to God rather than Egypt for their safety, so we are to look to God as being the only one who can ultimately supply our needs in every area of our lives. Over what area of your life are you distraught this morning? Is it your finances, your job, your own health, or the health of someone that you love, perhaps an unraveling marriage or other family problems? Maybe it's the condition of national affairs or world affairs overall. What gives you lack of peace? Over what are you distraught? In each of these areas, we look to God as being the only one who can protect and provide for us. He is the one who gives us our finances. He gives us each day our daily bread. He gives us the strength to go through the seemingly impossible times of life when there's family problems going on. He's the one who holds the affairs of all nations in His hands, who raises one up and casts another one down. So we dare not look to sources such as our own finances, our own resources or intellect, or the wisdom of man, or our nation's military might as our source of safety and provision. But we look to God alone. Even in a matter as central to the core of our existence as salvation and sanctification for ourselves or for those that we love, we have to acknowledge that it's all of Him. The work is entirely of Him. And we cast our prayers upon Him for our own salvation and walk with Him, the salvation of those that are so dear and precious to us, and their walk with Him. Well, the next section I call the application for the future. It's not that we wait till the future to start doing this. We do it right now, but because of what we're looking forward to in the future, we should be applying it right now. And the first is that we should look forward to that day when Egypt, Israel, Assyria, and all nations will worship God on His holy mountain in Jerusalem. It's going to be glorious. Look forward to it. But until that day arrives, we never cease praying for a great turning to God among the nations. Pray specifically for different nations. Michael gives us out a prayer earlier, and he highlights different areas of the world. We need to pray for those areas, that God's Spirit will move things and will open people's eyes and get the gospel message in there. And we'll, you know, it's not beyond Him. He's done it in history. That's why we're sitting here in a primarily Christian culture today, because some idol-worshipping pagans turned in a mighty way to God because God's Spirit moved at the proclamation of His Word. We need to pray for that to continue to happen in various regions of the world specifically. And also, pray for that salvation among those we know, regardless of how hopeless their salvation might seem to us. It's all of God. Jeff, would you come and lead our class in closing prayer? We have a few minutes left.